Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Maps Hysteria, a podcast all about Married at First Sight. And today I am extremely excited because myself and Omar are joined by an actual hero of mine. It's one of the experts from the show, the world's most prolific TV matchmaker. It's Mel Schilling.
Yay!
Oh. Kelly and Omar, thank you so much for having me. You know, I'm actually a fan of yours and I've been following your podcast for the last 2 years. So I'm a little bit starstruck right now.
Oh, thank you. That's amazing. I'm so using that on our posters.
Yep, you can have that.
I mean, off air, you did just say you were listening to him when you were walking near some cliffs and you were thinking about jumping.
Yes, I may have said that. Trigger warning.
Yeah, I should clarify for the listeners that you're in Australia currently filming the upcoming series of Married at First Sight Australia. So we really appreciate you doing this, given the time difference. I mean, it wasn't like the launch party, which we were lucky enough to be invited to. Was that 5 a.m. you had to do that?
It was. And then, of course, I got the lovely perimenopausal brain fog. I completely forgot what I was talking about in the middle of my chat. I don't know if you noticed, but I did. So no, it's a more civilized time of night this time.
I don't know if you could sort of gather it because you were on screen, but the response when you came on, I mean, the response to the other experts was amazing as well, but the response at the launch party when your face was on the screen, the room just lit up. It was amazing. You're so loved.
Oh, that's beautiful to hear. Thank you. I absolutely loved doing it. I had such bad FOMO. I so wanted to be on that stage with Paul and Charlene. I couldn't believe I wasn't there. So that was the second best thing, I guess.
Well, if it's any consolation to you, I think I drank your share of the free cider. So
thank you, Omar. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we sang quite a few dark things, I think it was called, wasn't it?
Yeah. Ooh, it was great though. It was good to meet some of last year's cast and met Charlene. Paul was busy being interviewed by Lad Bible, I think it was. Something I wanted to ask you first before we get onto Married at First Sight Australia was, I saw you post on social media you dancing. So a dance class that you did. And I don't know, I think it is just, I'm so used to just seeing you sat on a chair giving out advice. that it was just, it was a real shock. And you mentioned Strictly, and we talked about how the room lit up at the launch party. If you were on Strictly, I'd every week voting for you, definitely. I hope you get that. You were amazing as well.
Thank you. You didn't know I had legs, did you? You did not know I had legs on Maths. We were like little hand puppets. I do have legs and I do love to dance. And this is something I've just recently returned to. I was very much in the theatre, as big theatre nerd as a kid growing up, and, you know, went on to, you know, produce and direct and choreograph loads of music theatre. That is my passion. You know, you probably don't hear a lot about that side of me. Huge drama queen. And so, yes, that was me in a dance class. And, yes, I've got my eye on Strictly. Watch this space.
Wow.
Well, because I actually signed up for one of your confidence masterclasses, which we're going to talk more about in a bit.
Yes.
But you shared a story of when you went to a dance class and it was a little bit more advanced than you'd first thought.
Yes. Yes. And the takeaway message, I think, from that one was failure is feedback. And that was me practicing what I coach. And it's really, really hard. It's easier to suggest other people do it. Doing it yourself is so much harder.
At what point in the dance class did you note, did you think, hang on, I'm a little out of my depth here?
Do you know what? It was the moment we started, we did all the warm-ups and we were starting to do the, you know, the moves across the room, like the little combinations. And all of the girls, and I say girls because they were aged between probably 14 and 16, the incredible, you know, flexible, pubescent things. And one girl just breathed and her leg came up to here. It's a podcast. It's not a visual medium, but my arm is up by my ear as though that's where the leg was. And they said, we're going to do some jump turns and we're going to do an axle turn, which is basically where you do a turn, you tuck your legs up. And I thought in that moment, I don't know if my ankles will hold me when I land. I might shatter my ankles if I land on them. I don't trust them. I think I need to exit stage left. So I did. Went and had a stiff drink. God,
it's so interesting just seeing someone out of context, because we've seen you for
right.
years on Married at First Sight Australia, especially, which is how I got into the program. And yeah, it was just a shock to see you up and doing things. And you get kind of fixated on people, just the one perception that you have of them.
Yes. And I think there's a real danger of, you know, when you are involved in a show like this one that is a juggernaut, you know, and it just takes off, of people sort of seeing you in that kind of one-dimensional way and getting a little bit pigeonholed. But I'm going to put the word out there to watch this space, because I've got some damn exciting projects coming up in the next year.
Oh,
amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. While we're on your other projects, I have been an avid fan of the confidence work that you do with women. And like I said, I signed up for the online masterclass. I am three quarters of the way through your new book, which you've got out, The C Word by Mel Schilling. The C Word being confidence. And like I'd mentioned off air, and I read a lot of self-help books. It is a brilliant one for the people listening at home. I've used some of it with my little girl who's dead anxious about going to school. I've just been telling Mel that we made a little booklet yesterday with felt tip pens of things she could try to make herself feel more confident. But I was just wondering, what led you to want to write that book?
It's been in me for a long time. You know, you might not know my background is I was a psychologist, and I spent 20 years as a psychologist, and a lot of that work was working in organizations and coaching leaders, and, you know, working with people around performance and high performance, and, you know, working with high profile people and, you know, celebrities and leaders and sports people and so on. And I found that so often every coaching conversation that we would have would come back to one of the aspects of confidence. You know, and more often than not, that was about the self-talk and the stories people tell themselves that hold them back. And I started to get a sense that, well, it wasn't a sense, it was a very clear observation that there's a real difference between men and women. There is this gender gap when it comes to confidence. And I started to get really curious about that. And I stumbled across this piece of research. It was actually conducted by Hewlett-Packard. And what they did is they got a group of men and a group of women and got them to have a look at this position description, like a job description, and to basically assess themselves against this position description and then make a call as to whether or not they'd put themselves forward for this job. And what they discovered was that the men would apply for the job if they met 60% of the criteria. So there's a 40% gap, but the men still look at it and go, oh, no worries, I'm going to jump in and take a risk. I'm going to put myself forward. The women applied when they met 100%, not before, not 99, 100. So that was so powerful for me to think that men have this 40% gap to play with, and they actually see it as an opportunity. Even if we had a 1% gap, we would see it as a problem and a barrier.
Yeah.
And that was the piece of information that really propelled me into writing the book. Well, that and COVID, because pandemic equals lots of time to write.
Oh, wow, that's fascinating. And it's actually played out with us, I think, because we both had the same amount of experience in sound production, which is none.
Right.
When it came to recording the podcast, I was like, I haven't got a clue. We'll have to get somebody. Who do we know? And Omar was like, well, I'm going to teach myself how to record it.
Ah, there you go. Yeah. Case in point.
Yeah. It's a good piece of evidence for my support of the patriarchy. We get stuff done.
Here he goes with the patriarchy again. Ellie, will you gag this man? Put a sock down his throat. Omar and his patriarchy.
Well, this must be something that you see a lot over your years on the two forms of Married at First Sight. The lack of confidence in women especially. Is that one of the common things that comes up?
Yeah, it's definitely something I see in relationships where, you know, you've got a couple sitting on the couch or the settee, as you like to call it, Omar, which I think is adorable, a couple sitting on the settee. And, you know, quite often the conversations we find ourselves having with the women is around finding your voice. You know, you are in this relationship now. You need to really step into that power. You need to ask for your needs to be met. He's not a mind reader. You know, you need to actually find that voice. And, you know, this is generalizing, of course, but and oftentimes with the man, it is about listening more and allowing her that space to, you know, actually solve problems on her own, because you don't need to do it for her. And those kind of conversations.
Just before we go any deeper into those topics, I just want to give the listeners a bit of a background about how this interview came about, and ask you a question about that. Because, as you said, you've been listening since we started last year, but it was only after we'd finished doing the podcast that you got in touch with a very kind message and explained that you tried to take a step back from social media, that you might be open to an interview in the future. And then this year, again, very kindly got in touch and we set this up. But that one of your concerns was talking about people specifically, specific couples.
Yeah.
And is that because of your background as a psychologist, of seeing these people as clients or patients? Is that the reasoning?
That's one of the reasons. Yeah, you're right. So having a background in psychology, you know, I come from this philosophy of confidentiality and, you know, utmost respect for the information that someone gives me. So that's where I've come from. Obviously, that's not where I am now, because, you know, we as the experts on the couch, we're not in a therapeutic relationship with the participants. You know, it is more of a coaching role, a facilitation role, an observation role, you know. But I still, whilst I'm no longer working as a psychologist, I still bring those professional ethics with me, and it's kind of become quite innate. So I consider that, you know, any interaction between myself and our couples, if it doesn't make it to air, I'm not going to talk about it, because from my perspective, I feel like they haven't given me consent to talk about that. But it'd be different if they did. I'd be happy to. But, you know, there are many a conversation I have offline with individuals or couples, and I will never talk about that stuff. But then I guess the other side of it too is the whole, as you know, you mentioned social media and media, you know, particularly tabloid press, are very keen to take comments out of context and to turn them into something sensationalist. And, you know, I'm not in the business of turning gossip about an individual into clickbait. You know, I don't think that's cool at all. So I feel like the way I can contribute to the whole maths hysteria, so to speak, is by, you know, speaking more broadly. You know, definitely I love talking about the experiment. I love it. I love talking about themes that come out in the discussions that our couples have and what conversations are now being started in people's lounge rooms. I love that. I love pulling out themes and going, okay, this happened in this microcosm of this you know, reality TV experiment. What does that mean for real life?
Oh, yeah. And the issues that have been brought up this series have just been huge. And just, yes. I've always been a feminist. I'm quite opinionated. I'm quite passionate about things. But I didn't realise just how incensed I was going to be sometimes. And one of the issues that's been brought up is this idea of fat shaming. And it was something that Omar and I, we saw it differently because Omar saw it as somebody just voicing their type. And I saw it very much as, oh God, more pressure on women who've had pressure throughout history to look a certain way and for their whole financial security to be based on how they look. And so we were kind of quite divided on that issue, I think, weren't we?
To a certain extent, because I do agree that there's more pressure on women, obviously, than there is on men. I think anyone who disputes that is stupid.
Like you? Because I think what you said was we all eat shit, but it tastes different.
Yeah. Yeah, but no, what I mean by that is,
I can see the logic there. Yeah,
it's like the shit you have to eat is the pressure of your appearance or being a woman, whereas the shit I have to eat might be because of my race, you know.
Yes.
So it's different for everybody, but just purely in terms of appearance, the pressure on women is a lot more. But I sometimes felt, and it's not just on this series, sometimes people get bogged down on one issue and that isn't the totality of who they are, you know.
Yeah. Where would you sit on finding that balance between being allowed to have a type and voice it and then, hang on, no, this has now become fat shaming?
Yeah, look, I think types are useful to a point, and then there's a fine line between having a type and being completely closed-minded, you know, and whether that's about having some kind of prejudice against a type of person or just being really picky, it still becomes self-sabotage, you know, and it doesn't serve you. So I look at it from the perspective of how can you actually enter into this new relationship with the biggest possibility of success, you know, and if you are coming into it with this long list of things that are absolute not negotiables, then you're not going to be successful in this experiment or in your own relationships or, in fact, in life. So I think there's something to be said for holding your type loosely, you know, having an idea about what your type might be. And maybe that relates to some important stuff like your values and, you know, your life goals and your lifestyle and things that are important to you. But it's really important that you can have that openness to someone who might come along who's in a completely different package.
So when it comes to the matching process, which is, I'm sure you get a lot of criticism online.
Yes, absolutely.
Which, you know, often unfounded, because I think people do forget about all the success stories. I'm constantly reminding people of Adam and Taya, Cam and Jules from Australia. Yes. You know, this year, obviously, Zoe and Jenna. It's, every year there are success stories, but people always go for the ones of, well, he likes blondes and you've matched him with a brunette, you know, like.
That's right.
How difficult is the matching process? How much play do you have within that?
To answer the first part of your question, it is difficult. It's bloody difficult because there's no exact science here. You know, it's not like there's a formula that we can apply and therefore, you know, a perfect couple will plop out the other end. I wish it was. I wish I had the formula for that because I'd be a zillionaire. But it doesn't exist. And we're dealing with human nature, you know, so there's so much gray. There's so many possibilities of, for example, different people, different partners who could be a really good compatible match for person A, you know. So it is not a black and white scientific approach. So it's very much a composite of all different data points and different perspectives, and we bring all of that information together very collaboratively and make a call, which, you know, is ultimately going to be a balance between the highest predictable compatibility and what's going to make good telly. So it's a really interesting balance, because quite often those two things don't always go together.
What would you say, in your sort of vast experience, what's the most important indicator of a couple's long-term success? What would you look at first?
Well, interestingly, I would not say chemistry, because that's the assumption that a lot of people make, that, you know, that's what we're after. Is there a spark at the altar? You know, in my experience, I would say, I haven't run the numbers, but I think if I was to run the numbers and look at the number of couples in MAFS over the years who have had that instant spark, and the success rate, there would be zero correlation between those two things. In fact, many couples who have that instant spark and burn bright and then, you know, fizzle out pretty quickly, it's often the slow burn, as we call it, that tends to lead to more longevity within this experiment. You know, it might be slightly different in real life. But in terms of what would be the greatest predictor, I would think it would be a little combination of communication skills, a little cluster of skills that would include things like, so we touched on it before, that flexibility and adaptability, so openness. And within that little subset is acceptance as well. So a bit of acceptance for who this person is and, you know, some compromise and willingness to bend and flex a little bit, so important as a starting point, particularly in this experiment, because there's so much pressure. You know, you really need to be able to bend, otherwise you'll snap. So that's really important. I mean, a big one you hear us talk about so often is conflict resolution. And, you know, what is each partner's fight style? You know, are they someone who needs to run away and go into their cave for a time? And is the other person someone who runs toward the person and keeps talking and the other one's in the cave saying, give me some space? They're going, but I need to unpack this a bit more. You know, we see that combination quite often. And of course, in real life, we see that a lot as well. But then there's couples, and, you know, you, as I'm talking through these, you can probably visualize, you know, different members of the current, most recent MAFS group who played out this way. Then you might get a couple who are both have a fight style where they move towards and they attack and go into sort of fight mode, and of course that's not going to work either. So the couples who have a complementary fight style, but also that willingness to listen to the other person's needs, so to give them space if that's what they need, or to sit down and go through the problem in an itemized way if that's what they need, to take some time out, come back, work together through some kind of resolution. That little set of skills there is just so important.
Do you think that, how do I phrase this? Because I don't want to be
as awkwardly as possible.
Take your time.
Do you think, because I saw something from Paul basically that said that women are almost trained to date because women will talk to each other about dating and debrief and talk about, we had an argument and I did this and he did that, whereas men won't do that. Men will just, you know, go on a date and not even tell their mates or anything like that. Yeah. Do you think that gender divide is relevant when it comes to those kind of conflict resolution issues?
I'd like to think that it's changing. You know, that is, I mean, obviously that's reductive and it's quite a old school way of looking at things. I would like to hope that our men have moved on. And certainly, you know, I mean, I'm an old Gen Xer, but, you know, certainly the Ys and the Zs and the millennials are starting to show up a bit differently. You know, there is more openness to having those chats about what's happening on that emotional level and a bit more openness to sharing and getting vulnerable. So I'm an optimist. I like to think that, you know, whilst men are not at the same place that women are and probably never will be, I think that the men of the world need a little bit more credit, because I think they're starting to make some good progress toward that.
See, men deserve some credit, Kelly.
Yeah. Lovely cup of tea, to be fair. So.
in a little bit Little Miss Sunshine mugs.
Oh, cheers. I've got my tea here as well. Cheers, loves.
What I wanted to follow up on as well was going back to the matching process. Another thing Paul mentioned actually was the difficulty of casting, being that there's always accusations of people come on this show and other shows because they want the celebrity. So actually, although you might get more applicants, the pool of applicants is smaller because you don't want them all to be on it for Instagram fame.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge that becomes a little bit more tricky every year. You know, and I would say, you know, this is my 11th season, and I would say this particular issue didn't really start to rear its head until probably 3 or 4 years ago. You know, it's a very now problem as our audience becomes more sophisticated and as our audience starts to see the post-Max experience and, you know, with social media and tabloid media. Our alumni are often, you know, playing out their lives in that media space. And a lot of people look at that, you know, and through rose-colored glasses and think, wow, they're so glamorous and they've got these deals and they do collabs with very sexy brands and they live this life and it's all very aspirational. And, of course, there's the blue tick in the mix as well. And, you know, people are really, really a bit starstruck by that. So our job does become harder every year because it's so important that we can try to weed that out and make sure that, you know, the people who are coming into the experiment are there for, and I'm going to use air quotes here, the right reasons. There's so much talk about the right, are they here for the right reasons? But what I would also say is that two things can be true at the same time. So I think it's really important that if someone is within the experiment and they clearly are someone who's social media savvy and, you know, perhaps are an influencer or aspiring influencer, that doesn't mean that they don't want to fall in love as well. Both can be true.
Yeah. One of my most favourite things about the series is watching you and how you handle yourself when there is a man on the commitment ceremony couch and you haven't quite agreed with their behaviour. I think you're amazing at that, and I love you dressing them down, but in an articulate, helpful way. There was an article today, though, in The Sun, suggesting that the experts hadn't handled two of the men fairly. And I was just wondering, when stuff like that comes up, would you put that down to the editing then and what gets shown and what doesn't?
Yeah. Look, it's such a... I've got a very strange job. Let's be honest, this is not a normal job. Normal people don't do this job. It's very odd. You know, we put all of this work in for months and months on camera and don't see any of it until another person we've never met edits it and puts it on the telly and we can then watch it. You know, it is so bizarre. And, you know, every commitment ceremony could last, you know, 6, 8, 10 hours. You know, and in Australia we film them at night, so, you know, we, like the night before last, I got to bed at 4 a.m. You know, there's a lot of footage that is happening, and each couple will sit on the couch with us depending on what's going on in their life. You know, it can be over an hour. You know, we've had them there for 2 hours before, and that is constant us coaching, asking questions, listening, offering suggestions, challenging, holding the mirror up, all of that. And, you know, what you're going to see as that end result are the key storylines. You know, there will be stories just like you would have with, you know, a documentary, for example. But you'll pull out the key story that you want to tell about a couple, and that's what will be presented. So you don't always even get the best bits. You know, you get the bits that are relevant to the story. So I've learned that over the years, and I don't take that personally anymore because I could understand why. You know, it's about telling a couple's story and, you know, presenting it in the most logical way possible that's going to help the audience understand why they do the things that they do. And look, we did receive some backlash after last night's reunion, and that did come up. And all I can really say is that so much more happened. And, you know, to your point, Kelly, yes, I do call men to task. I call women to task as well. You don't always see that, you know. You know, I have been accused of being biased before because of an edit. In fact, it led to a great backlash against me in Australia, and it was very serious for a while there, you know, death threats and things like that. Yeah, but that's years ago. That's 4 years ago now. But now I guess I'm one step removed from it. You know, I can look at it in a different way and see that, you know, for example, I read that article in The Sun as well. And the way I look at that is, okay, I can see why the audience might think that, because they see a certain amount of time allocated to addressing this man's behaviour, but only a small amount of time allocated to addressing the other man's behaviour. So it looks like we're favouring one over the other, but trust me, I don't let him off the hook.
Is that a change you would like to see going forward in future series then? Just more time, just to show a more comprehensive view of what's been discussed. Is that something you'd like to see in future series?
Yeah, well, look, it's in the UK, the series is getting bigger year on year. You know, this year we had 30 episodes. In Australia at the moment, we sit at around 40 episodes. So there's definitely scope, you know, for it to get bigger. And, you know, in Australia, all of our episodes are 90 minutes, for example. I think there are only 60 there in the UK, aren't they? So, you know, there's definitely scope and precedent, you know, for this show to be bigger and longer and to go into more depth. So, yeah, I think that will be the way we'll be heading, and, you know, more opportunity to see more of what we do with our couples, because I know that the audience love that. They're very curious about what we actually do.
So something that Omar and I have ruminated on and are fascinated by is how you experts, only get to see the dinner parties and obviously the commitment ceremonies, but you're involved in them. And it's,
yes,
how hard is it trying to analyse the behaviour and the relationships when you're only seeing that one evening? Is it really tricky?
It's hard, but I think we've found a way to work within that parameter. So I go back to my time as a therapist. So I would sit in my office and a person or a couple would come in and sit with me, and I would see them for 1 hour, and I would make all of my assessments and judgments based on that experience of sitting in front of them. So if they demonstrate behaviour there, I can call them out on it. I'm not at home with them for the week before. You know, I'm not hiding in the cupboard watching them. I don't have hidden cameras as much as I might like to. I don't have the privilege of seeing all of that. I only have what they present to me. So that's the way I look at it, you know, and when you sort of look at it through that lens, it makes sense that we will only comment on what we see. I think, you know, and I have heard Paul talk about this, and I know he gets very frustrated that he doesn't get to see more, you know, what happens before we can have a fuller picture to talk to the couples there. And I do get that. I really do. But to me, that would be a different show. You know, that is a different premise. You know, I mean, this experiment is very much based on the idea that we come in and we see that snippet of that, you know, period of time while they're right in front of us, and we are with them in the moment. You know, it's not a documentary where we're, you know, sort of watching them in the fishbowl, sort of Big Brother style. That would be an interesting show, but it would be a different show. That's sort of how I see it.
I actually have a question from my wife, who
tell me, Claire. What does Claire want to know?
Oh, she'll be pleased that you know. That's, to be fair, I talk about her all the time.
You do,
but
she do. So she deserves to be talked about. All the time.
Yeah, I'm sure she does.
She's sometimes all right. She works for Child Adult Mental Health Services for the NHS.
Oh, great!
So she does a lot of therapeutic sessions with kids, especially, and. Her question was, how do you manage your own anger that you surely must feel when you're talking with people who are not taking on board what you're saying, and often, you know, again, just to bring it back to the men, who are often very defensive and coming back at you a bit. How do you manage your own anger in those situations?
Claire, you're a legend. What a great question, woman. Love it. Great question, because it is very real, and we do need to debrief ourselves as well, you know, so that the three of us will sort of, you know, we come off the set and have a good chat, download together and say, oh, wow, that happened. How did that feel? You know, that's a really, really important part of it, is to be able to do that downloading, you know, straight after. And then I have a wonderful support network. So I have an awesome hubby. Shout out to Gareth.
That's a good Welsh name, actually.
He's Northern Irish.
Oh, well, they stole the name from the Welsh. So.
Oh, controversial. Oh, yes. Okay. Do you hear that, all the non-Iron people out there? Oh, you're going to start a riot. So, yes, having him is so helpful. But I've got to say, it's tricky for us, Gareth and I, being in different time zones. I haven't got that, you know, my teammate on the end of the phone when I need him because, you know, he's often asleep. But now that I'm doing these late nights, like literally the night before last, I got home from a commitment ceremony. It was 3 a.m. He was awake. So it was great. I got to debrief there. So that's the informal stuff, is the informal debriefing, which is so, so important. And of course, remember, we're in this massive cone of silence. So we are quite limited in, you know, who we can kind of go and chat to about what's going on in the show. But then formal supervision is a really important part. So, you know, I have some incredible mentors. And, you know, very experienced one psychologist in particular who I can go to and say, okay, this really complex thing came up, help me work through it. Or I've got these ideas of how I could tackle person A. What do you think? You know, and so I've got those sounding boards that mean I don't feel like I'm just sort of floating there on my own. And I guess the other thing to be said is I have a rather expressive face. So in those moments where when I'm not exactly on board with someone, you know about it. To hide. Oh, I don't have a poker face at all.
It's amazing for me taking the photographs for putting on Twitter and everything. Everyone's got such an expressive face, but especially when we come to commitment ceremonies.
Right.
And the whole size debate that came up when it cut to you, I had three or four great pictures of you, one of which I may well use to promote this.
Yeah, do it. Oh, there have been some hilarious memes of my facial expressions over the years. Trust me, that's not new to me, and I love it. I love laughing at myself. Don't take myself too seriously. And look, I don't hide the fact that, you know, like you, Kelly, I'm a feminist through and through, and, you know, I have very strong views about, you know, gender politics and how communication plays out between either between men and women, or, you know, even in same-sex couples as well. You know, I have very strong views about the power dynamics, you know, and you certainly saw that in the last season of MAFS UK as well. Very strong views. So, you know, I've got to be very aware. I do need to check myself sometimes to make sure that I am being balanced, because I can, if I let myself go, I can be a little bit too focused on, you know, damn the patriarchy.
Well, Claire's way of dealing with it seemed to be to punch me and start.
Oh, yep. Start. Physical assault. Good yeah, start. Yep.
That's screaming at the TV. I had to remind her, I'm not Kwame.
Yep, got it.
It's a really interesting point, that though, being mindful of your own views. I went through a bit of a story arc myself this time, because there was something that I had a really strong response to. And it was the idea that came up was that there's a certain way to talk about sex, and there's a certain way that women should be allowed to talk about sex. And I very, very flippantly made a comment like, he's safe. He's a big boy. He can run away. And and I shouldn't have made that comment, because actually it was then used as sort of proof that I didn't believe that men could be raped. But anyway, I thought, no, I'm going to clear up my thinking on this, because I, like you, have very strong views. But so I got in touch with a friend who actually works for a rape charity. And I said, look, clear this up for me. She's saying stuff. He's not comfortable with it. Is that? And she went, that's very clearly a consent issue. So I had to change my thinking on that. But has there been an issue throughout your sort of MAFS history where it's made you rethink your views on something?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I'd almost say every season something comes up that presses my buttons, you know. I mean, I find I'm more than ever now that I'm more experienced and more comfortable in the role. I find I'm sitting in that chair and I'm 50-50 professional male and personal male, you know, and I'm bringing all of my humanness, you know, to that table as well. Yeah, and I'm very comfortable doing that now. It's taken a long time to get to this point, and I love that I'm I'm allowed to do that, you know, that I'm empowered to do that by the producers. They're very, you know, supportive in that way in the UK. So I find there's often one big issue, and it's not always the most popular storyline. You know, sometimes it is something that's a little bit more subtle, but I find there is always something big that is essentially a often about gender politics, or maybe it's about consent, or maybe it's about, you know, if I just ravel off some that have come up, we've had fat shaming, we've had revenge porn, we've had consent, we've had loads of girl code, boy code violations and what that means, you know, that's a very popular one. You know, we've had loads and loads of gaslighting. You know, we've had all of these things that, you know, people at home experience. And I think if this show can perform one function, and that is to give people at home some language and some tools around having those conversations, then, you know, I think our work is done. And that's what, you know, you asked before what I'd like to see more of, you know, what I'd like to see more of, you know, the coaching and so on. What I would like you to see more of is the actual intervention that we do. You know, quite often what plays out is a lot of, you know, what's the storytelling. So us sort of pulling out the story from the couples, which of course is really important. But what you often don't get to see, and it's just sort of a time thing, I guess, is what we then do with that information and how we hand it back to them in the form of, you know, really specific, here's your challenge for this week kind of conversation.
I think another thing which has come up with this current cast, even though there was a same-sex couple for the first time last year on the UK version, having two this year, just on our small slice of social media, I've seen the discussion and sometimes outright bigotry that generates. But I've got to applaud, like, Married at First Sight on having the same-sex couples, because Love Island, basically, it's frequently criticised for its lack of sexual diversity. So I do think it's important that those topics are brought up. It's not really a question, I suppose, but how important is it to you to have the same-sex couples on there?
Absolutely top of my priority, as is diversity around race and age and political persuasion. You know, I think this, our current cast this year in MAFS UK, I've just been so invigorated by observing the dynamics going on there. And I've been personally challenged, you know, on a couple of occasions in terms of just my own experience, you know, dealing with someone who maybe is from outside of my experience. And I need to, you know, make sure that I'm speaking to them in the right way that is going to help, you know, bring out their best. I think there's a long way to go, but we can do more of this. And what I'm loving about working with the UK production team around MAFS is there's this real enthusiasm for diversity and bringing in that richness of, you know, that social dynamic that can happen in a diverse group that you don't get from, you know, other shows that are all sort of, you know, what do I say, white, hetero, cis, you know, very, very bland, a bit like me, you know, quite bland.
If I can have a follow-up with that, actually, because I spoke to Zoe recently and she said that she was concerned, going back to the type issue, that, oh, yes, are the experts really going to give me the type that I want? Oh, are they going to hide behind, they're giving me what I need, not what I want? Did you have to do some research or broaden your way of thinking when dealing with same-sex couples, or was it just a case of people are people, you've got the tools?
It's a great question. And I did hear Zoe talk about this, you know, and you know, she self-identifies as a more masculine presenting woman. And she's really attracted to feminine presenting women. You know, she's openly talked about that. So, you know, I'm quite happy to sort of repeat that. And I'm sure she'd be happy with me saying that too. Yes, this is a completely different category of matching, you know, when it comes to, you know, the queer space, because, you know, of course, you know, if we think about guys, some are tops, some are bottoms, you're not going to put two tops together. That is the most ignorant thing to do, you know. So I'm very aware of this. And, you know, when it comes to, you know, people of mixed race or different race from a partner, what is that going to mean for them culturally? What is that going to mean for them in terms of how comfortable they're going to be opening up to this person? Or, you know, a massive age gap, you know, what's that going to mean? So, you know, these are all considerations. Are people just people? Yes. But when it comes to the queer community, there is a different set of needs. And so, you know, to your point, we do take consultation from, you know, leaders in the queer community, and we'll continue to do that because, you know, as a cisgendered straight woman, I don't necessarily know everything there is to know about, you know, matchmaking in the queer community. And I'm not going to pretend that I do. I'm actually incredibly open to learning about it, but I want to hear it from people who actually have that lived experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned there about sort of the trickiness of matchmaking. This fascinates me as well. Do you, Paul and Charlene, ever disagree when you're matchmaking people?
What do you think?
I think not that much.
I'm interested in how much you see. We do disagree. And I'm not sure how much of that actually comes across.
No, it doesn't seem like you disagree, does it?
No,
it seems like a united front.
It goes around the table and you say, he's got family values, she's got family values.
The matchmaking scenes. I'm talking more broadly, like across the whole thing, you know, we do disagree. Because if you think about the three of us, not only do we come from three different continents, we have three very different professional backgrounds as well. So we're an incredibly diverse panel as well. And, you know, quite often we will look at things very differently.
That's amazing. How do you resolve it? What's your fight style for resolving it?
Are you counselling me? Well, I think, okay, what's our fight style? I guess I can probably be a bit too combative. I think there's a learning for me. I think I need to probably calm my farm a little bit. Paul's very diplomatic, but he does get passionate as well. And I feel like Charlene's the most diplomatic out of the three of us. I think she's a great equaliser. Paul and I get a bit more fiery.
I think I might have guessed that.
Yeah. Having seen your facial expressions as we talked about before,
You've definitely
seen you ready to jump across the gap to the
yes.
I was going to ask as well, we spoke to Charlene about having essentially her own week, the intimacy week. Is that something you would like? Is it, you know, more tasks or more one-on-one time with the couples?
Yeah, I'm going to say watch this space because there's a lot of new ideas swirling around for the next season. And yes, you might be onto something there, my friend.
Oh,
I'll take a cut. That's fine.
We'll have Omar week.
I would love that. Something I wanted to ask, we spoke about with Adrian, was fashion.
Yes.
Because you always look fantastic, and not just you, the other experts. Personally, as someone who sat here in a Adidas top, I would feel so much pressure, especially this year. The fashion stakes just seem to keep going up and up. You don't want to be the person who turns up, as I would, in jeans, T-shirt. You know, is there a lot of pressure on that front?
Well, I am absolutely delighted to reveal that I have a secret weapon. And she is my stylist by the name of Ellie Witt. And she and I work very closely together. She gets me. She absolutely gets me. And she comes around to my house with literally suitcases full of the most sensational pieces. And we have this day of just trying stuff on. It's basically every fashion lover's dream. And I just get to try stuff on like I'm a big doll. It's divine. It's heaven. Absolutely heaven. And she gets me to try things on that I would never even dream of. Colours and shapes and textures and things I would never even think of, because she's very creative and she gets me and my shape and my style. And so I absolutely love it. So we're keen to just, you know, up the ante every year. Bring it on.
How big will the podcast have to get for me to be able to afford a stay?
Well, I think we need a sponsor.
Yes. We need a sponsor.
Do.
Yeah. That's the next stage.
Having listened to our podcast, what advice do you have for mine and Kelly's relationship?
Oh, yes, I like this. So let's take the patriarchy example, shall we? Because that seems to be a point of contention between the two of you. And Callie, I'm sorry to say you're a little bit too much like me, mate, in you get very passionate, just like I do. And even though it's a podcast, I can tell what your face is probably doing when I hear the passion in your voice. You might just want to ask yourself if you listen to Omar's point of view enough, if you are giving him space to bring all of his manly testosterone-fueled views to the table, because he has a right to a voice as well. And oh, Omar.
That's it. I'm blocking you on social media.
That's it. Block, delete.
No, do you know, that is my weakness, but it's my weakness in arguments in my personal relationship as well.
Right, yeah, me too.
I think it comes from a sort of fear that I won't get my point heard. So I then, I sort of thrust it at Omar and he just has to.
Yeah.
Suck it up. I totally, yes, you're right. You're absolutely right. I don't know how capable I am of change, but I will try. We're about to record our final episode after this, and I think everyone's going to be like, Kelly was very rational and measured this time.
You got a big dose, an injection.
It'll be really boring.
Exactly. No one would listen.
So one thing that I've found, Mel, is because my background's in drama and singing, and I think people would assume that I'm quite confident. But as I'm getting older as a woman, I have this little voice. I think it's, you know, my imposter syndrome saying, who are you at age 40 to go and try and be a stand-up comedian? And age is becoming a thing for me, and I don't want it to be. So I had signed up for your confidence masterclass, and I was just wondering what advice you would give really to somebody who's, I mean, everybody has a reason to feel underconfident, but that's mine at the moment.
Yeah. And it's that little voice in your head, isn't it, that says, what gives you the right to do this? Who do you think you are? Everyone's going to laugh at you, and not in a good way. Yeah, I know that voice. I have that voice too, and so many of my clients do. Look, it really comes back to self-talk and that story that you are playing on repeat in your mind. And one of the things that I find can work really well is to have to create your own fantasies, and not the kind of fantasies that Charlene talks about. These ones are not bedroom-based ones, although they could be, but not necessarily. But fantasies about positive things happening to you. So a daydream about, you know, for you, you're standing on stage, you know, you deliver your set, everyone's in bits of laughter, then everyone comes up to you afterwards and tells you what a great job you did, and that they wet themselves laughing, you know, buying you drinks. That's the outcome. And to really visualize that successful outcome. I mean, they use this technique in sports psychology, you know, those outrageously successful athletes visualize themselves winning that race, kicking that goal, getting that hole in one months before they even, you know, step onto the pitch. And this is something that we can do. We can borrow from you know, the elite athletes, is that sense of daydreaming a rehearsal with a positive outcome. And it just, if you do it every day, it'll create new neural pathways. It changes your mindset and your way of thinking. And it just is so incredibly powerful.
Thank you. I'm smiling just listening to that. How can people sign up for your masterclasses? Where should they go?
Well, you can now just go to my website. My gorgeous team have just created a new page on my website, which is just melanieschilling.com. And there's a shop page, so you can buy my book. You can buy my audio book. I've got a whole range of different little mini courses and so on that are on there as well. And I have a series of little mini masterclasses coming up that I'm running with different women. So the first one coming up, I'm running with a woman who is an actress, actually, who had to overcome a physical disability in order to create this incredibly successful life as an on-screen actress. And, you know, I've got someone coming in to talk about money, relationship with money, you know, body image, all these different topics. So really all these topics that women like to talk about and as they relate to confidence. So they'll be coming up as well. And drum roll, please. I'm working on a podcast which will be launched in February next year.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. This is exciting. This is something I'm so excited about. It's very early days, but I'm working with a fantastic team to make sure that it's just positioned exactly right, because I've got so much I want to talk about. You know, you can guarantee there will be a feminist flavor. It'll be directed toward women. It'll be about confidence, but so much more. It'll be about the stuff that women want to talk about and how that stuff can help us live a better life.
Oh my God, that sounds amazing.
I bet you'll be happy as well to be in control of the editing process of that.
Exactly. That's the thing. A podcast is just mine. That's it. That's a really good point, Omar, because it'll just be my views edited the way I want them. And, you know, there'll be a lot of video as well, because, you know, with such an expressive face, why would you waste it?
Yeah.
So along with the podcast coming early next year, we can next see you on our screens. We think Married at First Sight Australia is going to be February, kind of March time, is it?
I think so. I think it'll be around March. And I have some other projects in the works as well. You know, I'm a budding producer as well when it comes to TV. So I certainly have some top secret projects that are bubbling away and moving toward development. So watch this space, guys.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Oh, what a pleasure. I've loved every moment. Thanks, guys.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.